Bristol. Bristol. Community FM 93.2.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show, Friday Drive Time, with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Freemasonry in the police and in the government. We hear some sordid details of their secret initiation ceremonies. Corruption in local government. We hear tell why some people believe land has been given to friends of local authorities. And we question the rules for council officers, who, of course, never have to face election themselves. Are they too safe in their jobs? And I'm joined by a community activist and an engineer who both believe that Freemasons' networks are being used by criminals to keep whole communities down. But first, to this morning's incredible by-election win by George Galloway in Bradford West, winning well over half the vote and knocking Labour, Lib Dem and Conservatives out of the park. What does Bristol's Respect Party make of this morning's landslide victory of George Galloway in Bradford West? Well, I'm joined by Paulette North, who's a former Respect candidate here in Bristol. Paulette, what do you make of it? You were cheering just then.
Oh, I was. It was absolutely fantastic. I woke up this morning to the news on my text, and I've just been phoning round and talking to people about it. I've been to a conference today, Black South West Network, where I spoke about it, because it is fantastic. It's an alternative. He's beaten the sad old Labour Party up in Bradford West, and we're going places.
So why do you think it's taken so long for George to get back into politics, and why is he out of the Labour Party? Why can't the Labour Party embrace him?
Well, that is old history, and I won't go into all of those issues. But I think he made some comments today about the Labour Party, didn't he? About how, you know, he still maintains cordial links with them.
Well, but he still likes them. I mean, he was saying basically he's damning the Lib Dems and the Conservatives perdition, but he does still care about the Labour Party.
Yeah, well, and I think, you know, at the time in opposition, Labour will talk up left. But today, I was at this conference and I said to people, when do we ever hear politicians talking anti-war, anti-privatisation? We don't. And yet everybody at this conference that I spoke to agreed with me about that. You know, the community is being cut to ribbons in Bristol. It was about community cuts, about equality, about human rights. And, you know, nobody's standing up for these issues. We have a real alternative here.
Now, a lot of people are also saying that they see the main three political parties, the Lib Dems, Conservatives and Labour nowadays, as really three different wings of the same party.
Absolutely.
A one-party state, which is really run by the people with money in the city.
Mm, absolutely. Well, I would totally agree with that. I don't think there is very much to differentiate between the three. And in fact, sometimes Labour actually sounds as if they're more conservatives than the Conservatives with their policies. And look at what's happened with the National Health Bill going through, you know, the Condem government. It's just absolutely appalling. And so here we do have an alternative, because the mantra that's been out there is all we've got is Labour. Labour have come back, they're talking left, let's vote Labour. So I'm saying no, let's vote Respect.
Well, we're going to see George again now on the news and on parliamentary Prime Minister's questions and things like that. Ultimately, it doesn't really mean anything, does it? Because the three main parties have still got, by far, a massive majority. There's only his little one voice and
one or two others. He hopefully will be able to block with Caroline Lucas, the Green, and you never know what will happen in the next elections. But it's given Respect a lot of heart, a lot of hope. We were out today. I've just come back from a demonstration with the Save St Paul's Carnival. We had the Respect banner. We had the Barrack, Black Activists Rising Against the Cuts, of which I'm convener of in Bristol. And so, you know, we're out there. We're at every struggle. we're supportive, we're in that struggle, we're there, we're active, we're campaigners, and that's what we need to see, don't we, on the ground. We need to make sure the trade unions have got their rank and file sorted out, because we really need to build.
Now, Martin Summers, just to bring you back in here, Old Labour Oxford economist, we've been hearing from the trade unions, particularly PCS, that they are even thinking themselves about standing political candidates in the future. What is happening with the Labour Party, where we can see incredible changes like this thing going up on in Bradford? It doesn't seem like Ed Miliband is really able to be the voice for the whole Labour movement. And is it, you know, what are your thoughts
about
this? Well,
I think the model for Britain is what happened in New Zealand in the early 1980s, because in New Zealand, which has got a fantastic Labour tradition, they built the first welfare state in the world in the 1930s while we were still hanging around. And in the 1980s, they voted Labour to keep out the Thatcherite policy that was being pursued everywhere else. But in actual fact, Roger Douglas, their finance minister, they immediately then privatised the railways and was actually in the pocket of Wall Street. It was quite obvious. But the Labour activists in New Zealand were still mobilised, and they immediately smashed their own party. The unions withdrew funding from it. They went out and got a referendum on PR. You know, and I think, you see, if we had PR, and this is a liberal cause, supposedly, then, of course, Respect's voice would have been heard a long time before this. But, of course, we don't have PR, apart from in Northern Ireland, Wales and Scotland, of course. It's all becoming more interesting.
But isn't this really just a blip on the horizon?
I think it's an earthquake. I think it's a wake-up call. It's a wake-up call to the Labour leadership. A wake-up call to the Labour leadership.
But are they going to wake up?
They'll have to. Ultimately, we're going to have to build a coalition of forces to change this society for the better. And there are good people all over the place. The Green Party, elements within the Labour Party, and so on and so on. Sinn Féin, SNP, I've worked with those people. Plaid Cymru are very good.
Yeah.
You talk to Plaid Cymru, they're excellent.
But we can pull all these parties
together and create a coalition of forces, and we can go forward together to change the society for the better.
But what you're talking about is a little fraction of the Labour Party and all these little minnows. They're never going to be able to face the main parties.
No, because ultimately, who funds the Labour Party? It's the trade unions. And at the end of the day, they are going to get fed up with paying for people who are not going to do what they're supposed to do.
And also, I don't underestimate community voices either. Don't underestimate the people, because they're getting fed up. The other day, outside the BRI, Claire Hall put round on her phone a message. She got 30 the first day. The next day, she got 150 people there that had come from all over to have a go to protest about that National Health Bill. That could spark off at any moment, at any place, any time. We could see a huge change. You could get people like Claire Hall. She's fantastic. She's absolutely fantastic. A young person who did it. Let's see more of these young people doing it.
The other thing I would say is, I'm 52, and I'm so pleased to see this younger generation come on stream.
You don't look that old.
Well, it's radio, so
yes, you do.
Doesn't really matter. But the point is that I often say to a lot of these people are my friends. Claire Hall, I used to work with in Columbia Solidarity, for example, and I just say to them, we are so pleased to see you lot.
Absolutely.
We are so pleased to see you lot. Now, you know, they are better informed than we were when we were their age, and I hope that they can pick up the torch and carry it.
But at the end of the day, Martin, this is only actually a bit of a fringe, marginal political movement when it comes to actual influence in Westminster, isn't it?
Well, the point is that the Westminster system has become completely dysfunctionally corrupt. The Tories are trying to gerrymander the system. They're going to change the constituencies. They're going to keep first past the post. They're going to have voluntary registration for voting, which they hope poor people in poor areas won't register. And then they're going to draw the constituencies on the back of that. This is the kind of thing that the Ulster Unionist Party used to do in Northern Ireland in the 1950s and early 1960s. And if the Tories think that the British people are going to swallow it, they're going to have something, you know, they're going to need a bigger police force than the one they've got.
And watch the Occupy Bristol people. The occupied.
Well, that's
people.
All finished now, isn't it?
No.
Well, it's not over. It may be finished down in on College Green. But that whole movement is massive. Watch out for them as well. What's going
to
happen?
What I think is important, Paulette, is we've got to move towards a more pluralistic way of doing politics, where we allow a variety of voices. Yeah. Like, you've got Respect and the Green Party, for example.
Yeah.
Natural allies, but they've got a different different analysis.
Yeah. Okay, finally, Paulette, do you think we're going to see anything like this happening in Bristol? Because it's not a totally dissimilar, you know, we've got a big ethnic minority population in the city. You know, what's your thoughts on that? Are we going to see a Galloway-type figure possibly grabbing a seat in Bristol?
Who knows? Who knows, Tony? Let's look for an alternative and let's see respect. Yeah, I think we'll have a showing, yeah.
Martin?
Yeah, I think Bristol is one of the most progressive cities in the country. And we, you know, in terms of the, you know, in terms of the political activism going on, I'm not talking about the people running the show, I'm talking about the people who are around.
Yes. Yeah? I would agree with you.
And there's lots of campaigns going on.
Absolutely.
And I think we've got to build a mature dialogue. I mean, look at the way the Irish Republican movement have built a mature dialogue, even with their bitterest enemies. That's the way forward.
Yeah.
Okay, thanks very much, folks. Now, today, Friday, was the day of the demos. Four big demonstrations, well, not necessarily big, but demonstrations at midday. We had an anti-vivisection day at AXA, opposite the Magistrates Court. 2 p.m, we had a pro-squatting demonstration up Stokescroft by Tesco's in the Metropolis. At 2, also, we had a Save St Paul's Carnival demonstration, which Paulette was saying she was at earlier, at Malcolm X Centre. And at 6 o'clock, we had the workfare demonstration, just about now, a demonstration at the bandstand in Castle Park. Lots of activism going on in the city. But this weekend we have something called the Drone Conference, and there are two drones conferences going on over the next few days. Bristol Against the Arms Trade has got a conference on the video game killers and the war crimes called Down the Drones Conference. That's taking place on Sunday. That's at 1 p.m. to 6 p.m. at the Arc Cafe in Bristol in the city centre, where there'll be speakers Maya Evans, who's just returned from Afghanistan on a peace delegation. We've got Joanne Baker, who's been on the show a couple of times, co-author of Uranium in Iraq, The Poisonous Legacy the Iraq Wars. And there's also Chris Cole, possibly the most educated activist on the growing usage of drones in modern warfare, and also someone from Smash Edo, which is a Brighton-based grassroots campaign against MBM ITT company that makes bomb racks, release clips and arming mechanisms for warplanes and drones. Smash Edo activists have carried out numerous direct actions and demonstrations against Edo's Brighton arms factory. Someone from the campaign will be speaking about war, arms, manufacture and direct action. Before we hear a little clip about the drones, Paulette, can you just give us your thoughts on this kind of warfare? Because it's a little bit like, I mean, I see it almost like people playing video games, and also the people who are actually doing the killing are sort of thousands of miles away from where it's actually happening. Isn't this a little bit disturbing?
Well, I think it's more than disturbing, isn't it? I mean, I grew up looking at the little television in the corner of my room, in the corner of our room in a boarding house in Margate, being Vietnamese, having a Vietnamese father, Vietnamese origins. The Vietnamese War was immediate, was there. The B-52 bombers that came over, I remember those. And in fact, we were sent in England rings which were made from the B-52 bombers. So warfare, you know, we've got, you know, advancements, haven't we, in this? And it's just awful, isn't it? I mean, any type of warfare is disgraceful. So, yeah, not good at all.
Okay, well, the other thing is there is a pro-drones conference going on as well. That is the long-anticipated Bristol Drones Conference, which is due to take place on Monday the 2nd of April and Tuesday the 3rd of April at Armada House, Telephone Avenue in central Bristol. So anyway, let's have a listen now to Professor Anthony J. Hall and his view. He's the author of the book Earth into Property, and he's also a Canadian professor, and his view about drones and the effect that this kind of thing is happening on the world today.
We live in a time where the big pollution we're dealing with is the pollution of the mental environment, the engineering of psychological conditions which facilitate invasions. Like when you think, you know, sending drones into Pakistan to attack whole communities, well, how is that possible that society allows that to happen on our behalf? We even are asked to pay for this. It can only happen if on some level we've dehumanized those people on the receiving end of the drone attacks, of the white phosphorus attacks, of the depleted uranium attacks, if we've somehow been sold a line that these are not really fully human people, they're kind of terrorist people, or their families are inclined to terrorism, or their religion is inclined to terrorism. You know, we've seen this dehumanization of populations in preparation for terrible things. We saw this in the Second World War. We saw this in Nazi Germany, where whole populations, gypsies, Jews, were depicted in the media as sort of subhuman, as scum. So when, you know, the concentration camps, when the full murder campaigns are underway, the surrounding population are willing to accept it and be complicit in it and even be involved in it. So we're seeing that with the poisoning of consciousness towards Arab people and, of course, the larger community of Islamic people. Incredibly to me, we living in the 21st century, who would have imagined that we live in a time where religious wars are being sort of sold to us?
That was Professor Anthony J. Hall, and he's the author of Earth into Property, which was the independent national newspaper's recommended book choice for Christmas last year.
Drive Time on BCFM, 5 till 7 on 93.2 FM.
Now, the Freemasons, and I'm joined in the studio by two people who've rubbed up against Masons, or at least they believe they have. We'll find out if they really have or not. First of all, to Glenn Jenkins from Marsh Farm in Luton. Hi, Glenn.
All right, Tony.
Now, first of all, Glenn, politics and community activism, because you're quite a community activist. What's the difference?
The difference between politics and community activism?
Because we've just had two politicians in here, and they are certainly what we think of as politics. But you're a community activist. It's a different kind of politics, isn't it?
Well, it's politics, as they call it. You know, I mean, I'm not really into party politics and all that, because, I mean, George Galloway, who you've been talking about, he says it's like voting for two cheeks of the same bum. And I kind of share that view. Not in particular.
Or three, even.
There's some great councillors. There's some great politicians. My local politician, Kelvin M. Hopkins, is a great bloke. Kerry, your local MP, used to be a councillor on the estate next to us in Luton, funny enough. And I couldn't believe it when I see Kerry. So there's some great people. But as soon as they approach the seat of power, everyone turns pink. And pink is, you know, what one model of capitalism or another model of capitalism, what one do you want? Community activism is a completely different thing. That's about organisation by the people, for the people, of the people, and not representative democracy as such, but more participatory democracy.
So what stops people actually just organising for themselves, as you've been doing in Luton?
Well, there's a lot of there's nothing that stops us doing it apart from a mindset of provision being provided to the provision culture, which is quite jealous in its provision, because, you know, I say by the people for the people. Some people prefer by big business and corporations for the people. And when you try and organise, as you'll get into with my story in Luton, when you organise effective alternatives to the provision culture of big business, then they get uppity, and then they get downity, and then they get nasty.
Now, many people might have come across you on the telly a few years ago doing a swap with the leader, I think it was of the Young Conservatives, where you went to his home and he came to your place.
I didn't go to his, he came to ours.
Oh, okay, he came to your place.
They wouldn't let me in Cambridge.
How did that go?
It was brilliant, mate. We had a good time. It was an enlightening experience for him, because he came in thinking we were all sort of hippies and, you know, didn't have a brain cell to rub together, because we'd all been smoking dope for years, and therefore we were sharp. You know, that was his approach, a typical top-down view of the world. And it was funny, because it was like he was coming out. It was like an MP factory or something where they make them. And he was a young version, and he'd come out, and he ended up halfway through the week. We made a guest of him all week, and halfway through the week, he decided to have a moral hiccup and go and report us to the police, when the whole programme was supposed to be about the legalisation of cannabis. And, you know, so that just showed you a serious lack of integrity. I remember saying to him, you're not a truth seeker, James, you're a job seeker. And it was like Adrian Rogers, who was a kind of right-wing Christian conservative guy. He'd met with him on the radio, done a radio show with me on the Thursday. And Adrian had said to him in private, well, I couldn't morally be in a house where people are smoking cannabis without reporting them to the police. And James obviously thought, I need to do that, because that, you know, he obviously took that on board and went and reported to the police. Happily, the police said, well, you're not really telling us anything we don't really know about anyway. So it was quite an eye-opening experience. But, you know, for James, it was a bit of a career wrecker, obviously.
Okay, so what have you achieved with the community activism in Luton? I mean, there's a tremendous amount over the years, but, you know, what are the real highlights for you?
the highlights for me are the organisation and promotion and doing of self-help community initiatives, ranging from entertainment, providing entertainment for, I mean, look, let's face it, yeah, 92 when we started was the last so-called recession, and I couldn't then and can't now afford to go in pubs like millions of other people. I ain't got £4 a beer, got a couple of mates, so you have to run to the toilet when the round's on, you know what I mean? It's impossible because we're commercially excluded, we're economically excluded, and there's millions of people in this country. So advocating and promoting and doing self-help activity in the field of entertainment, back in 92 we had to squat places to provide that, and we led to a 40% decrease in takings in some of the pubs locally. Well, that got us in trouble with a local bit. I mean, our Lord Lieutenant of Bedfordshire at the time was none other than Samuel Whitbread, who is one of the biggest beer dealers in the country, and those 40% drops were, so he leaned on the police, and then the police leaned on us, and the rest's history.
What about Freemasonry, though? What point did you realise that there might be some Masonic connections, and what evidence did you actually have?
Well, what brought it to our attention at first? I mean, we knew that both of our local Conservative MPs were Masons. We knew that anyway, because we're very locally rooted, and the bloke who used to chauffeur them to the lodge told us, yeah, so we had some, we knew that, and we weren't surprised by that, John Cullen and Graham Bright. But what was strange is that the local Labour Party, the Labour group, was supporting us, very actively supporting us, because we were clearly doing it for locally social beneficial aims and ends, and we were trying to work with the council to make these events legal. But there was this one guy, the leader of the Labour group at that time, who just refused carte blanche to meet with us, to talk with us, flash in the pan, I refused to meet with him. It was sort of illogical, irrational, because the rest of the group were with us. And he tried on several occasions to get me put in prison with contempt orders and injunctions, and, you know, three times I was up in the High Court, and he kept targeting me personally. And eventually a journalist from Bedford wrote to me, or phoned me, and said, I think I've got something you'd be interested in. They brought it down. It was a 1984... Masonic yearbook, and in that was none other than our socialist leader of the Labour Council. I took that straight to his colleagues in there, and they were shocked. Roy Davis, his name was, I took that book to his colleagues. They were deeply shocked, but then they chose to believe that he'd left the lodge in 84 because he started the council, and that was his story. We didn't believe that. We were disgusted that they believed that, so we squatted the town hall for a night. 70 of us got down to the town hall when they were meeting and made a little protest, did a conga. Davis is a Mason and all of that, trouser legs up and a bit of fun for 15 minutes, and the next day it was high profile news. And then we found a 95 yearbook, which was 11 years later, and he was still in there. So, you know, his behaviour at first in being irrational, in not supporting us when the rest of his colleagues were, and then his connections became clear. Now, the thing is, Tony, within 2 years of us exposing that in a very high-profile way, we found ourselves in High Court three times on framed-up charges, so framed up that the Beds County Council eventually voted unanimously for a civil rights inquiry chaired by Michael Mansfield QC into what they called the activities of Bedfordshire Police and others against the Exodus Collective. And one of the reasons for that was because three times we had three High Court judges brought in who we then discovered were the only three, apparently, Freemasons in the High Court. Lord Justice Drake, Lord Justice Millett and Lord Justice Balcombe. Within 18 months or 2 years of us out in the Labour leader. So who works in the list office for the judges? Who were able to bring these judges in? Because you're not going to tell me, out of all the judges in the country, that it was a coincidence that we all of a sudden were confronted by the three most powerful Masons in the judiciary.
No, I'm not going to tell you that, Glenn. Anyway, we're going to have a chat to Jerry in a minute. But before that, back in 1999, James Garrett, who's head of news and current affairs at HTV here, before it became ITV West, did what I think is one of the most outstanding half-hour documentaries about Gloucestershire Freemasons. And one of the things he did is whilst he was actually taking part in the filming of it, they left him alone in the actual Masonic Lodge up, I think it was up in Chipping Sodbury. And they left him alone, and he actually had a look into what opened up one of the cupboards and found a human skull in there, and he found two crossed bones. And this, it turns out, was actually part of the initiation rite. So let's have a listen to a short clip from that documentary now, which is available on YouTube and other places online.
Once the blindfold is on, you're then sort of led to the door. Something is placed over your neck, which at the time you don't know what it is. Find out later on it's actually a rope with a noose around it.
I think one's always a little nervous and apprehensive about things that you're not sure what's behind it or you know what is exactly going to happen to you.
You feel a slight pressure to the left breast, which is sort of like a pinprick.
Some now, you can see that they are virtually petrified coming in, and in my position, often sitting near the top, near the master, you can see everything coming in, and you can see them almost shaking, but they soon relax, and they always say they've enjoyed it at the end, anyway.
What role do skulls and crossbones play in your ritual?
They are... what role does skull... Well, yes, there are some skulls and crossbones which are part of the regalia of the lodge, or the emblems of the lodge, and they represent mortality, basically, that we all have to end our lives eventually.
An ex-mason was more forthcoming. He explained that the bones are used in the third stage of initiation, in which the candidate undergoes a form of ritual murder.
So you actually sort of struck on the left temple with a plumb roll, struck on the right temple with a level, and then the master gets out of the chair and attempts to hit you with the maul on the forehead, stopping, fortunately, just short of your forehead. But you then pushed backwards and lay down on the floor. What you're actually laying on in the lodge that I was in was a cloth on which was depicted a coffin. In other lodges, it could actually be a coffin.
That was James Garrett's documentary there. He was the head of news and current affairs at HTV up until fairly recently, talking about the Masonic initiations and the involvement of the human skeleton, the human skull, and the crossbones as part of that. Now, I'm also joined by Jerry Coulter. Jerry, you're a martial arts expert and an engineer. Can you just tell us a little bit about yourself? An engineer? What sort of engineer?
I'm a mechanical engineer. I generate my own income. I'm involved in project work, all sorts of engineering projects.
What about the martial arts side?
Well, I was one of the first white boys out in Japan fighting the Japanese in the karate schools. I came out of a boxing background, and I was involved doing that since the 1970s.
And what about your education? Where were you educated?
Well, I was educated when I was in West London at Harrow, and that's where I did the boxing, and I originally trained in the martial arts at Harrow Leisure Centre under Master Tatsu Suzuki, who was one of the most senior Japanese instructors to come to this country to teach Wadaru karate.
Well, martial arts, maybe you were one of the people who would be very much notice it if Freemasons got in your way. So what happened?
Well, it's a long story. A lot of it, as I've mentioned before, but rather than going back over old ground, basically, if you want to view websites that I put up at www.dorsetvictimsupport.org, you can see a lot of it on Mason's Corner. There's also a lot about that ritual that was just being spoken about, the third degree ritual. We also have published there a lot of publications where we've had Masonic publications come into our possession. And as a result of police misconduct in Dorset, I've got hold of a Dorset Masonic membership list where I first started looking at Masonic hanky-panky, and then found it spilled into planning. I found Masonic councillors vating through property developers in their own lodge, planning applications, not once or twice, but a course of conduct that amounted to misconduct and a breach of the local the National Code of Local Government Conduct.
Now, you also worked a place I worked myself actually a while, which is BBC in Southampton. You made at least you didn't actually make the documentary, but you helped them make a documentary about the Freemasons in the development and the planning system.
Well, this is what I'm saying. When I was lobbying about police misconduct to councillors on the police authority and county councils, I was being threatened, and I couldn't understand why I was being treated by the good and the great in Dorset, the so-called checks and balances, like a bunch of thugs. And when I was talking to other councillors...
Well, when you say that, what do you mean specifically?
I was actually getting threats, like, be careful when you're doing these things. Something bad's going to happen to you. I mean, bearing in... One Dorset policeman even told me, quote, aren't you worried that you might get hurt one night when you come out of a pub or someplace in the dark?
And so I suppose as someone who's been trained in martial arts, you don't take this sort of thing lightly.
Well, when you've been fighting in Japan, doing full contact, knockdown karate and knocking out, I want to see who this master is who's going to come and hurt me. You know, I'm an engineer and a logistician. In fact, I even said to one Dorset policeman, do you play golf? He said to me, what's that got to do with it? I said, well, bearing in mind, I do knockdown karate. I box, still now, at my age now, right? Physical violence is what I do for sport and relaxation. Threatening me with physical violence is like me threatening to take him to Sunningdale Golf Course and pay his green fees.
What about the planning system? Because obviously there's a lot of money to be made in development and planning. And one of the things you found out was that this company, Fry's, were actually involved in... Well, they had friends in the planning committees who themselves also were Masons. So who are Fry's?
Basically, what happened was I was trawling the planning record and I found out that one particular councillor had voted through 13 planning applications for Eddie Fry. That is a course of conduct that amounts to misconduct, an incriminal offence, misfeasance. They knew that they had to declare an interest and stand themselves down. Once, you could say, probably as an oversight, a couple of times, probably a smack on the wrist or a telling off. But 13 times is a course of conduct that amounts to misconduct. If you breach a code of conduct, it is misconduct.
Well, I must say, on that documentary, the BBC Southern Eye documentary from 2000, the reporter actually confronts one of the Masonic councillors on the planning committee and says, and actually asks him on live on the camera, did you have any other interest in this particular application? And he says no. And then the reporter then sort of puts it on him, you know, but you are a Freemason in the same lodge as the developer.
Well, I was doing all the research for him. I was the one that had the guts to go in and film him voting for his mate's planning applications in the town hall. That's why I was working with BBC. And I expected that Southern Eye programme to go out nationally. It was scheduled in the TV guide to be shown where I live in Hertfordshire. And they pulled the plug on it because it was getting too close to Eddie Fry and Prince Charles. Because at that time, Eddie Fry, whose planning applications were the subject of some of these things, was the main property developer for Prince Charles, who was building a town called Poundbury, as big as Dorchester, if not now bigger, on agricultural land bordering Dorchester. And it was just getting too close to Bonnie Prince Charles.
Well, that's an interesting one. But I mean, you know, you would have thought that if it had been exposed that Fry was breaking the law through not declaring his interests, at least he and the councillors together, that, you know, he would maybe be stopped from putting in these planning applications, or at least there'd be some sort of question. But it's the opposite, isn't it? Because he's actually
He has been stopped now. He's now confessing himself to his great architect of the universe. He's passed away.
Oh, right. But his company's still
his
there.
His company's still there and still the main developer on Poundbury. Yeah, his son's run it all.
Now, that's supposed to be a massive, wonderful example of how we should be building towns in the future. So what do you think about that? They're saying
it's a massive example of how the planning process works. If you really want to see the incestuous nature of the Dorset authorities, you should go to our website we've put up at www.dorsetpolice.tv and look at a video that we've put up called David Cameron's Big Society. It shows the whole way of how they've all been milking it into meltdown. They've been taking exactly what they could get out of the ratepayers' trough. All of these pigs have had their snouts in the ratepayers' trough, milking it for what they can. And now they're pleading poverty. And it shows the whole incestuous relationship of all of them. And then you couple that with the BBC documentary that I got out, and it shows a pretty bleak picture.
Now, Glenn was talking about these Masonic yearbooks. I mean, there's something called the Freemasons Yearbook, which is a massive annual national thing. But then there's also these provincial yearbooks, the small ones. Did you find that they were the things that you had to use to expose these Masonic connections?
The provincial yearbooks are the key to the lock. I mean, I've got the Hertfordshire one. Our friend here, sorry, your name again,
Glenn,
was fortunate enough for a reporter to give him a Grand Lodge of Bedfordshire one and show him... all the people, all the snakes that are hissing in the same pit, if I can put it that way. And of course, I was able to get a Hertfordshire one, and I started looking into Dorset because I was being threatened by them.
Now, for a lot of people, they may come across this kind of bullying that you've had, what they think may be corruption, but what advice have you got for those that think they might be dealing with Masonic corruption?
Get hold of a yearbook. I mean, I'm not a conspiracy theorist. I mean, one of the reasons why I don't have a problem with the Masons in Hertfordshire is because I've got their books over the last couple of years. I know exactly who's hissing in which pit.
Yes, but they keep these books so, very, very secret, Jerry. Well, how do you get hold of them?
There's very secret ways of getting them.
Okay.
But put it this way, right? Once you know who is urinating in the same pot with who, then, as in my case, I don't have any problem with them in Hertfordshire. Because if they keep out of my way and I keep out of theirs.
You can expose them, but actually, ultimately, you know, you've shown, I mean, you've given evidence that there are criminal offences taking place, and it seems nothing's been done about it.
You've got about as much chance of having a fair hearing in the courts in this country as you will have in Lagos. In fact, you'll probably get a better hearing in Nigeria than you will have here. But at least you won't get a judgment handed down to you by United Grand Lodge.
Glenn, what are your thoughts about Jerry's story?
I just think generally the problem here, right, in terms of Freemasonry, look, I'll make a declaration to you. My dad was brought into the Freemasons through the Caravan Club, yeah, because like, they've got what they call the Blue Band Lodge, yeah, and there you're like harmless. My dad was a school caretaker. Might have been a handy place for meetings, you know what I mean? But he came out of that, and you know, I know you'd say you can't come out of it, but he disassociated when he got ill and found out that the benevolence and brotherhood and all of that was just nonsense, you know, unless you were one of the powerful ones. So my view on it all is that, you know, they're not all bad, they're not all, but there's a core within there, and because of its secrecy and because of its closeness of information kept and all, this secret society, they say it's not a secret society, it's a society with secrets. It's like a badminton club. Well, like my man said, I don't think there's many badminton clubs where you get a third degree ritual murder to get into them, sort of thing. So I just think it should be publicly open. Chris Mullin opened the Home Affairs Select Committee. We were invited to go and give evidence to that. I'll give you a tiny bit of the evidence of judges and all that. There's loads of evidence behind our case that suggests Freemasonic messing. And Chris Mullin was taken off the job. All of a sudden, he was promoted to minister, and that was the end of the Home Office Affairs Select Committee investigation.
Well, we had the situation after that, that the Standards Board was told that they have to put a little section on all the declarations of interests of all councillors, saying, "Are you a member of a secret society?"
Yeah, but that's the point. You know, that's asking a free look. There was a lodge called St James Lodge.
That, by the way, isn't there anymore. I had a look on a recent one, and it seems to have disappeared. They've lobbied.
But that's what
to
I'm saying. Exactly that, and they're powerful. There was a lodge called St James Lodge in London, which was a manor of St James, which was a police lodge. They were told by Kenneth Newman, the chief constable, everyone has to declare. They just carried on regardless, you know. So there needs to be, they've been given enough chances to come clean, and I think now there needs to be legislation of some sort that says, look, you know, this is something because of the conflict of interest. Even our councillor who we outed, he said, where contracts are concerned, I accept there could be a conflict of interest. Well, exactly, councillor. You know, what we need is complete openness and transparency. And then I've got no problem with people who want to whop around with their trouser legs rolled up and their chests exposed and rapiers to their heart and nooses around their neck and all. You know, you want to get on with that kind of stuff. In as long as we know, if you're going into public office, we want to know that you're in that club.
What was the problem, though, you know, if you're in public office?
The problem is, as I say, that, I mean, Jerry's just gives some great examples where you've got people sitting who are property developers. Remember, Masons ain't like badminton. They swear an allegiance to each other, right, that says that you are, we will protect you. They've got symbols for protection. So the problem is that if you've got someone making a planning decision, if you've got someone, in our case, you know, they should have been supporting someone which was for the socially excluded, but because of the monopoly of the brewery man, of the magnate, this council has all of a sudden taken a position of hostility to us. So it colours their judgment, it affects their decision making, and it should be open because there's massive vested interests, massively powerful people spending billions and billions of public funding, and we demand that that should be something which is open and transparent.
Now, Jerry, this whole business of declaring interest, I mean, like I said before, it should be a criminal offence, and yet we're seeing very little. You know, we're not seeing these big, high-profile trials of Freemasons who have broken the law, are we? We're not seeing them going to jail.
Well, this is why we're making our own documentary videos now and posting it at hmcourts-service.com also ministryofjustice.tv and
dorsetpolice.tv. So you think that most of the activism, I mean, certainly for you, the internet is proving to be a useful tool to get this information out there.
We're making our own documentary videos now and putting it up, our own documentary films to present the evidence. Getting back to Chris Manning's committee, the key evidence that I got the BBC working on to get the programme put together, I sent to Manning's committee. I tried to give evidence, bearing in mind I had a Dorset Masonic yearbook. I'd also trawled, I'd done the legwork. I'm not a conspiracy theorist. I'm an engineer, a logistician. I'm a number cruncher. I'm a numbers man, right? I found that most of the magistrates in Dorset are orbiting three lodges. Those are mathematical common denominators that cause for alarm. Even the chair of the committee that appoints the magistrates was one of the most senior Freemasons in Britain, Michael Fulford Dobson. He didn't appear in a Dorset book because he's in Grand Lodge of England. He appeared in a Grand Lodge of England book.
Well, when I did a tour of the Freemasons Hall here in Bristol, this is a few years ago, and you can find it up on the internet. It's Bristol's Masonic Religious Cults Open Day. That's right, I think it was the headline for it. I noticed that one of the Bristol magistrates was almost like a little foot soldier. He'd been posted on sentry duty at the top of the stairs, left on his own for about 3 hours just to make sure nobody went down the stairs. So you can see that within the Freemasons, it's quite possible that somebody you've never ever heard of is a master of a lodge and telling magistrates, judges and people like that what to do, Glenn.
Absolutely. And do you know when we found out the three judges who had been drafted into our case, I mean, one of them was a very serious case, and they were drafted in, they changed a judge, and that was what put our you know, a month after we'd occupied the town hall, all of a sudden we're told the trial's being brought forward. It was a trial for murder, and the guy wasn't guilty of murder, wasn't found guilty of murder, but it was made into a murder trial, and there was a judge brought in to the picture. Now, when we exposed him, when we realised who he was and we exposed him, in fact, we challenged him, and our QC made a submission to him. I think it was the first time in British history, criminal history, that a judge had been asked to stand aside because of his Masonic interest, and he did stand aside. Now, the point is, when we then investigated him, we found that he'd been the judge who cleared a man called Applegarth down in the Bryn Estyn scandal, down a child abuse issue down in Wales. And this very same judge had made a closing speech. I remember Simon from Scallywag wrote about it, and he made
Simon Regan. In fact, he was kicked out of working for the Sun when Rupert Murdoch bought
exactly,
it.
Exactly. Yeah. Now Simon Regan had wrote a piece saying the curious summing up of Justice Drake. And what was curious about it, Tony, was that the judge had made in his summing up testaments about how good this copper was, and the copper was demonstrably lying about his having visited this kid's home. And he said he's an upstanding member, he's a Freemason. Now, the judge at no time felt it necessary to declare, by the way, I'm a Royal Arch Freemason. My job is I'm the highest in the country. Now, surely to God, in that case, if he's supporting and curiously summing up in support of a person who's being accused of really serious crime, he needs to say, by the way, I'm a Freemason too, yeah? And we swear allegiance to protect each other. Now, that was a case which has never, ever come back. It's never, ever been brought back to account for it, you know? And yet there's potentially the crime of the most serious nature.
But we come back in a way to what Jerry was saying about Lagos and Nigeria being thought of as corrupt, but actually corruption could be sitting in some of our most important institutions. And one of the best writers, I think, on the Freemasons, because it's a complicated subject, if you want to get your teeth around it or your head around it, it's probably best to get hold of one of the bog standard books, and one of them is called Inside the Brotherhood, and it's by Martin Short. And just before Christmas I met up with Martin in London and asked him what he thought about the Masons.
My name is Martin Short. I've been a journalist since the late 1960s. In 1989, I had a book published called Inside the Brotherhood, which was an exposure of Freemasonry. It followed on from a book called The Brotherhood by Stephen Knight, who unfortunately died almost immediately after his book was published. I took on the work and wrote what was a painfully long book, 500 pages on the Freemasons, and astonishingly, it is still in print. I'd always been aware that Freemasonry was a force of some sort in this country. Like many people of my generation, I was aware that previous members of my family had been Freemasons, going back to my grandfather in Weston-super-Mare. However, my father was not a Freemason and would never have joined, and yet I was aware that it was always an organisation about which people would suddenly descend into whispers when the subject came up, and being a perverse sort of character, naturally attracted me to looking into them. By the time of the mid to late 70s, I co-authored a book called The Fall of Scotland Yard, which was about massive police corruption in the Metropolitan Police during the 60s and 70s. And lo and behold, it turned out that the most corrupt squads were staffed entirely by Freemasons, which meant that it wasn't just a coincidence. It became clear to us at that time, my co-authors and myself, that these people were, as it were, reinforced in their corrupt acts by the fact that they would never be betrayed because they all belonged to this brotherhood which believes that you should stick up for each other and basically shut your mouth if you know something naughty's going on.
How did you know that these officers were Freemasons, though? Because we often hear allegations, such and such is a Freemason or might be. How can you go about, as a journalist, actually pinning that down?
It is notoriously difficult, and I noted in a recent article that somebody alleged that some of the News of the World material had been gathered through Masonic connections. What you need by evidence is you have to come up with the lodge list. Lodge lists are notoriously difficult to get hold of, but there's nothing better than producing a document which shows them, as it were, all brothers of the same lodge. Now, when it came to the Metropolitan Police at that time, we couldn't prove that they're all members of the same lodge, but in the course of the evidence, and there were three massive corruption trials, and a lot of the material I was able to cross-reference because a helpful solicitor provided me with all the paperwork. And it turned out that there were frequent references to Freemasonry. And one of the attempts to discredit a police officer who dared to testify against them was that the money that they used to stick in his drawer on his desk at Scotland Yard was not the proceeds of kickbacks from pornographers, but was in fact their fraternal donation to his Masonic initiation fees, because they knew he was a bit skint. Now, in the course of the whole case, it came out that they frequently bunked off work at about 4 o'clock to go to their lodge meetings. Also, astonishingly, the chief superintendent of that outfit, an officer called Bill Moody, who is now dead, he had this terrible habit of going to a Freemasonry lodge with a pornographer, and in fact he initiated this man into his own lodge. I think he was already actually a member of another lodge, but the idea that a policeman and a pornographer would be frolicking around in the same Masonic lodge is somewhat distasteful. And then later, astonishingly, we came across a Masonic lodge in Southgate, London, which the master was an armed robber, and it turned out that 8 members of this lodge were police officers, and that he had even been the master of the lodge when a police officer was initiated into Freemasonry. And I met this guy later, and you couldn't believe that this man was a worthy member of any society, let alone a secret one, but also that he was just really rather stupid. And it suddenly made you feel that Freemasonry was in fact not staffed by masters of the dark arts or people of you know, supernatural powers, but in fact they're just a load of geezers who join together either out of greed or fear in the hope that somewhere, somehow, this outfit can help them when help is needed.
This outfit can help them when help is needed. That's Martin Short there, author of Inside the Brotherhood, which is still in print, something like over 30 years after it was first written. Glenn Jenkins, you're still with us. This can be a bit disempowering, can't it, to think that there's this kind of secret shadow network. We even had the Queen saying there's forces in this country which you have no knowledge, which is rather a sinister thing to say to Paul Burrell. And it can be a bit scary, can't it?
Well, do you know what, Tony? Right, and one of the reasons I wanted to come on your show is to say that what's scary about it, if it is scary, right, is that it's only scary if they can do it quietly without the light being brought to it, without people knowing about it. The real hidden... This show's about hidden power. You invited me on hidden power. Yeah. The real hidden power is the power of an enlightened, awake, informed community. Because a community which knows, a community which has the power of knowledge, we are the force. Yeah? There's the real hidden power, is the power of a united and informed people. So I love to... I'm blessed to be here today because I wanted to not only share some of our experiences in the time we've got, but also to say to people, don't be frightened, be enlightened. Yeah, don't be scared, read, find out. Join with your neighbours, join with your friends, join with your brothers and sisters. And there's nothing like the power, the hidden power of an informed and united community. And then and only then, it becomes not frightening, but history in the future, that you can have such dark arts taking place around public money, public funding and public wealth and well-being. Well-being is perhaps a Freudian slip there. That's what we've got at the moment. Public well-being depends on information and enlightenment, and that's why I'm pleased to be here tonight.
Well, thanks, Glenn. And the other thing, of course, is that with the beauty of the internet, it's now actually quite easy sometimes to get hold of these provincial yearbooks, because many of them secondhand are actually for sale. You can go to places like alibris.com, or else one of the most simple ones to use is bookfinder.com. And yep, if you put your own county and provincial yearbook into the search on there, you can quite often pick up quite a key document, which is actually possibly evidence of criminal activity, which can be used in prosecution for a fiver or something.
Drive Time on BCFM, 5 till 7 on 93.2 FM.
Now I'm joined by Esmond Jenkins, who's from Cotswold District Council. He's a Lib Dem councillor at Water Park Ward. Hi, Esmond, and welcome to Drive Time.
Good evening, Tony.
Now, you've been looking at some corruption, and we're not necessarily saying it's Masonic corruption. I noticed you're flicking through the provincial yearbook for Gloucestershire there. That's been going on, you believe, anyway, up in the Cotswolds. Can you just give us the background to it?
Yeah. Well, this started... I moved from London, or from Surrey, in 2004, and never been involved in politics, came with my young family to start a life in a rural environment, mind your own business. And what happened over a period of months was a number of developments started to be rumoured locally, which initially we presumed were entirely above board, you know, in the public interest. And one of those was around Kane's Country Park, which was basically an 85-acre country park owned by Gloucestershire County Council, and had been owned by the County Council since 1972. There were various rumours floating around, but the bottom line was that a developer was brought in to take over the park on a whopping 114-year lease for the princely sum of £1 a year. We, as a local community in the Cotswolds, you know, this is a very traditionally conservative, certainly a light blue area. Lots of retired people, lots of retired professionals started to get involved and ask questions, and we ran up against the a phalanx of opposition from the county council, from senior officers and councillors.
But well, I mean, this is the disinterest and the denials by officials. How do you react when something like that happens? So what you're doing is you're reporting what you think is something dodgy, and get the people who are supposed to be looking after these things just aren't listening.
Yeah, and it went beyond that. They paid lip service, and I suppose that, you know, I'm 53 now. I was in my late 40s, you know, worked in banking, you know, and would have thought myself reasonably open-eyed and realistic about what goes on in the world. But here I was getting involved for the first time with local politics in a rural environment, and what we were seeing was basically people turning a blind eye to what turned out to be overt corruption.
Now, last year, as you've told me, you've given me a bit of information here, the chief executive of the Cotswold Water Park Society Limited, Dennis Grant, was jailed for 4 years after being convicted of a £700,000 fraud, despite repeated warning to local authorities, which bankrolled the CWPS. It was left to you and local residents to unearth the fraud. How on earth is that, you know, if the officials aren't doing it, you're saying it's basically what Glenn was saying, in a way, is local people have to get together and address these things.
Yeah, and that is the power, and that's, and you know, in the Cotswold, you've got a, this is again a very conservative area, and what we're actually seeing is people, retired people, who've held big jobs, professionals, airline pilots, who are actually taking up the cudgel and challenging the local authority, the local regime and the local political establishment.
Well, sounds fantastic. But ultimately, what have you learned from this? Just as to wrap up, finally, for the listeners, what have you learned from your experience?
Well, I think I would say exactly the same as Glenn, is that the real power is in real democracy. And what you can't do is be complacent. Don't presume, because you drive past a council building, that all is above board and run reasonably well. In my experience, it's not. It's anything but. And it's not run for the general public interest. It's run for the commercial interests of a few.
Also, just to remind you that Jerry Coulter's website is brand new website, which has also got quite a lot of YouTube clips and things like that on it, is www.ministryofjustice.tv. So that's all the serious talk out of the way, because Friday night on BCFM is Music Night, 2 hours live now with Pat Hart and the Fresh Blood Party, followed by the UFO Show. Thanks very much to our guests in the first hour, Labour MP Kerry McCarthy and Lib Dem MP Stephen Williams. Also to Cotswold Councillor Esmond Jenkins, to also Glenn Jenkins from Marsh Farm in Luton, and also to engineer and martial arts expert Jerry, to Old Labour Oxford's economist Martin Summers. Next week, our Good Friday special, where we peer right down into the rabbit hole to look at the possibility that the Nazi Party wasn't actually defeated in 1945. It just took off its uniforms and sauntered into Civvy Street. Every BCFM show is available online. Just go to bcfm.org.uk, or even easier, thisweek.org.uk takes you straight to this show and our archives. A podcast of this show is online 10 minutes or so after broadcast. I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. The music this week from the Freemasons, just to prove they're not all evil, featuring Amanda Wilson with Love on My Mind. Do please join us for Friday Drive Time at 5 o'clock next week, and don't let the banksters or the Masons get you down.